Hello and welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Finsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. What does it take to create a truly equitable healthcare system? From entrepreneurs to investors to community workers from across the globe, this season we're speaking to the people aligning capital and technology to find the answer. This episode is produced in partnership with the Johnson & Johnson Center for Health Worker Innovation as part of a series investigating the trends, challenges, and opportunities in the global healthcare sector. My guest today is Lois Pace, President and Executive Director of the Global Health Council. Lois is a leader who has mobilized on the ground in more than 15 countries, delivering health programs and mobilizing advocates. Before her role at the Global Health Council, Lois held leadership positions in global policy and strategic partnerships at the Livestrong Foundation and the American Cancer Society. Over the course of her career, Lois has championed policies for access to essential medicines, testified for congressional global health appropriations, and elevated the voices of people at the community level around various shared advocacy goals. She has been recognized by the Union for International Cancer Control as a young leader at their World Cancer Summit and has been an expert advisor in high-level forums hosted by the World Health Organization, the U.S. National Academy of Medicine, and other policymaking bodies. Welcome, Lois.
Thanks for having me, Paul. I appreciate being here.
So I'd like to start by asking you about your personal journey in global health. What first inspired you to build your career in the health sector?
Well, let's see. It goes back to growing up in the inner city here in the U.S. I was always pretty motivated by health and wellness, I think because I saw it and my family seems to have seen it as something over which we had control, something that would help us endure some of the stressors around us. It was quite violent and there weren't things like fresh fruits and vegetables in my neighborhood. And frankly, you delve into sports or you delve into nutrition as a way to kind of center oneself. At least that's what I was sort of raised to do and understand. And so it's something that then translated to the work I wanted to do. Ultimately, I always wanted people to feel like they had access to that opportunity in that way. And it led me to really seek out what I came to understand as public health and community health. And lo and behold, here I am doing that on a global scale.
So I guess I have to ask that kind of pre and post pandemic question, which is, you've been at the helm of the Global Health Council during the COVID-19 pandemic. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to ask what lessons you've learned over recent months about improving health security or achieving better health equity. How has it reframed, if it has, the way you have thought about public health?
Yeah, you know, that's interesting as well, right? Because the pandemic has really been a slap in the face for a lot of people, if not everyone, but particularly those of us who have been working in public and global health. And I think what it's done for me and the people with whom I work is really challenge a number of assumptions we have had, either knowingly or unknowingly, about the way the world works and our role in it, particularly as Americans, right? And so one important lesson that I've been trying to pay attention to and help others sort of resolve is this idea that the US or the UK or other quote unquote wealthy countries have it all figured out and simply need to help or otherwise support other countries that might not rise to the same level of economic or political heft. And the pandemic has been a great equalizer and a very important one as we now consider all of the ways that at home people are struggling and suffering from the pandemic and its aftermath, but B, really how we truly need to work in solidarity with people around the world, with other governments and countries to understand how best we respond both at a national and an international scale So that's been critical, honestly, I think, for those of us as public health professionals to admit that readily and to then try and work towards how to reshape or reframe the goals that we have for the work we do.
So I guess the pandemic has also thrown up the sense that a set of frontline public service employees, be they firefighters or teachers or health workers, the kind of people who are critical to our society, but who all too often are taken for granted and underpaid and not properly represented. It's really highlighted how vital they are and what a vital role they play in our society. And I guess I'd like to ask you, how in your work have you sought to ensure that their voices are heard and that their voices translate into policy making or public policy?
Frontline health workers and others on the front line, to be clear, have been critical. They've been lifesavers, right? And it's not just about who's providing healthcare, which is critically important, but it's caregivers who are finding ways to still nurture families, particularly children who are out of school, but other parts of families and communities. They deserve all the accolades as well. And what I've been trying to do is really get out of the way. I mean, I'm really happy to have this interview with you, for example, but I'm also heartened to hear that you're talking to other people who are doing this work, who really are on the front lines and in different parts of the world. Because again, what's happened with the pandemic is it's created a more level playing field such that we have greater access to and pay more attention to folks who aren't like me with a platform, but who are really doing God's work, as they say, on the ground. And if nothing else, what I'd like to do is shine a spotlight on those people and the work that they do, or elevate them in some way, you know, bring them onto the platform that I have so that other people really know what's happening. And we do that, I mean, in my organization through special stories, either that we feature in social media or that we bring to a policymaker to help them understand, you know, the work happening on the ground. I've had my own sort of similar conversation series where I've tried to pull in people that we know who are doing great work and who can, again, help us understand the reality for them and allow us to sit still and listen and learn from what it is they have to offer.
So I should imagine that a key element in establishing equitable healthcare systems is establishing a robust and effective and indeed just payment system. And I'd like to ask you what you think an equitable payment model for healthcare looks like and whether you think there are countries that are doing this particularly well that we might want to look at, study and refer to.
I struggle a little bit with the idea of payment, or at least starting with payment, because for me and for a lot of us, the real issue is around access. As I'm sure you're aware, and I've heard maybe from others you've interviewed, one of our priorities is to improve access to healthcare worldwide. And there's been a great push for universal health coverage over the years, and it's particularly in recent years. And so that's where I start, right? I really start with the quality and availability of services from citizens across a country, whether they be, you know, in the most remote or marginalized communities, whether they have the, you know, highest income, we really want to, or lowest income, to be clear, we really want to be sure that people have the greatest access to care that they can. And yes, if people have an ability to pay, particularly those at a higher income level, then we need to, of course, fund the system, but governments themselves should be funding it to a great degree, or to the greatest degree required, for those with the least to still be able to receive those services. And so that's really how I think I might reframe that question, or my response to that question is to really see it as threefold. First of all, availability of the systems or services, right? Access to those systems and services. And then finally, affordability.
I wonder if you've found, I mean, one of the kind of cardinal attributes in healthcare systems is a sense of predictability, reliability, trust. And one of the things about this pandemic is that it seems to have been overshadowed by political sparring, politicization, misinformation. Mm-hmm. And how do you begin to rebuild that sense of trust between citizens and those in authority when it comes to health messaging, and then also ensure that amongst all the priorities of policymakers, global health becomes really a top priority?
That's a really important question. So I'll take the second part first, which is how we keep global health top of mind or front and center. You know, in a US context, and again, for the work that I do on a daily basis, we're constantly trying to ensure that Congress in particular here, or the White House and all of our federal agencies really are working towards the goals that we collectively and globally have set for global health and its programs. And I'd like to think that it will be much easier now moving forward to convince them that global health is an issue, right? Even during something like the US election cycle, it's been said that global health in particular, but even something like foreign policy or international affairs aren't really voting issues. But I think this year, especially, there are many people asking candidates for office about global health issues and especially the pandemic, right? And so I think that it's our responsibility, certainly, to leverage this moment. And I say that somewhat gingerly, right? Because it's been such a tragic occurrence. But I also call it responsibility, because if we do not learn from this tragedy, and if someone like me doesn't help others understand how we can avoid this type of crisis again, then I've failed, right? I mean, we've already failed in that this has happened when we knew what to do and how to avoid it. But if history repeats itself, then I am quite concerned about what we've all done to really show up in this moment. Now, it's not a given that just because everyone has experienced this and because we've gotten them to pay attention that, for example, the U.S. Congress will continue to do the right thing and fund global health. And I do think to your point of trust, but even beyond that, right, there's just a general reaction to the pandemic that we as advocates have to really look out for. And we've seen that play out politically when it's come to these nationalistic viewpoints that have been thrown out by some countries who have said, you know what, we have to take care of our people first. We have to be sure that we keep supplies for ourselves. We have to outbid others on treatments. We have to win the vaccine race. And I understand where that comes from. But that's something that I think we're going to be very much up against as advocates, is ensuring that the response to this crisis isn't this sort of inward, selfish, sort of go it alone attitude or mindset, but the opposite, right? Because I think if nothing else, something like a pandemic shows us how much all of us are in this together and we need to act accordingly. We need to respond accordingly with funding, sure, but also with engagement, right? A country like the U.S. has to stay at the table at an agency like the World Health Organization, for example, because it's going to take all of us to solve this problem that affects all of us. That's how I'm trying to, I guess, unpack not just what's happening now, but how we respond later. And I'm hopeful that we can do that. But it has to be a very deliberate process whereby we bring people along and ensure that on the other side of this, we're doing right by people and ultimately more successful because of it.
So you've been at the helm of the Global Health Council since 2016, which also coincides with the beginning of the Trump administration. And earlier this year, the United States, despite what I would say are pretty widespread criticism, notified that the WHO, the World Health Organization, that it intended to withdraw. So can you explain to us why the relationship with the WHO is so important to global health efforts against COVID and beyond?
WHO does so much, and it's really fascinating now to have, especially Americans, be able to rattle off those letters. And so their awareness of the organization is good. I just wish that they came to know WHO for different reasons, right? But now is the time to educate them. And so what we've tried to help people here and elsewhere understand, frankly, is how central the WHO is to global public health. They have done everything from fight polio and really beat that back to near extinction around the world to respond to pandemics like COVID-19. And what a lot of people don't know is how much the WHO works either at the front of the line or behind the scenes on these types of issues that could be facing us, right? People in my generation don't have to worry about things like polio and even largely, and especially up until recent years, something like measles and other outbreaks, because the WHO has been so successful in rallying the world and rallying other countries, companies and the like to combat these issues. And so they're really critical when it comes to how we mobilize around a global public health problem. And I believe over the years haven't necessarily gotten the attention or credit for that work because they do such a good job working on behalf of countries and other governments, right? And they do such a good job working on behalf of global citizens. And it's not to say that they haven't made missteps and learned from those things, but the reality is if you were to take away the World Health Organization, there would be no institution that could come and take its place, that can come and convene all of these actors around essential medicines or supplies or, you know, negotiating price points for those types of resources, let alone delivering the services on the ground, you know, being embedded in local hospitals or health ministries to ensure we're truly responsive to the world's global health needs. There's no substitute for the WHO, however flawed it might be. And so it behooves all countries to really sit at that table if they do want to ensure the health of their people. And I would like to think that most, if not all, governments would want to be ensuring the health of their people in the middle of an outbreak and beyond.
So now I want to turn to the work of the Global Health Council itself. You collaborate with organizations around the world to amplify your work in international healthcare. And I'd love to hear from you which partnerships you have launched that have been particularly successful and why.
Oh, this is a hard question, Paul, because we cover a lot of ground. We don't do all things, but we do many things. And so first off, we work from AIDS to Zika. Right? We don't focus on one particular health issue or another. And we think that's important because people are not sort of organized by disease, and yet they are at risk for a range of things. And so we want to be the organization that is looking at health holistically. We also, because we are global in name, at least, are mindful that we're not just thinking about a certain subset of the population, right? But we're looking around the world at the ways communities, countries are affected by global health problems. Now, does that mean we do it all? Of course not. And we absolutely work in partnership. And so some ways that that's worked well has been starting with the AIDS to Zika framework. We recognize that there are different communities that care about different global health priorities, whether malaria and tuberculosis or cancer and heart disease, or say generally maternal or child health issues like family planning and nutrition. And we, I'd like to say effectively, convene those various communities, particularly in the US, to help them understand each other's priorities and kind of pull together their recommendations so that we are speaking to Congress, speaking to the White House, speaking to WHO, and even elected officials at the UN, about a joint set of priorities and coming together with sort of consensus recommendations for policymakers that affect each of those priorities, right? And something like universal health coverage is an example of that kind of broad-based recommendation or ask that we have as advocates that Global Health Council is able to kind of mobilize people around, if that makes sense. And we do that, we sort of mirror or replicate that with some of our global partners. There are coalitions that operate somewhat like Global Health Council in the UK or in on the African continent. And so we're able to liaise with those organizations or alliances to some degree so that we also can come together around these sort of consensus recommendations. Another way that we work in partnership is we don't just limit ourselves to, say, nonprofit organizations or organizations that are doing work at the country or community level, nor do we limit ourselves to advocacy coalitions or alliances. We're also working somewhat in partnership with the corporate or private sector. And that's important because they also have a huge role to play in health and healthcare. And I think we're mutually honest and even careful about setting parameters for those relationships and understanding where we might diverge, frankly. But there are areas where we come together with industry, for example, around health data and surveillance, or the provision of healthcare services and frontline health workers, or even rallying around WHO, right? There are a number of areas where it's important to bring all people to the table. And while there are some groups who certainly are more or less comfortable kind of reaching across the aisle and working across sectors, it's something that at least we try to create the space to do because we see value there when it works.
So I know you partner in order to advance innovation in healthcare, and I'd love to hear from you what research or new technology or breakthroughs you are most excited about right now.
Oh, goodness. A couple things. I mean, it's hard not to talk about COVID since that's the news of the day. I am very hopeful about vaccines. And I say that as vaccines plural, right? There will be not just one, but multiple COVID vaccines that come out of this global effort, the first of its kind, at least in our lifetimes, to really, if not find a cure, I discover some sort of protective mechanism for people at risk for this particular disease. That's really exciting. I mean, to really have multilateral institutions or organizations come together with industry and to some degree with community stakeholders and healthcare workers to try and develop and disseminate something so groundbreaking and life-saving, that's what we're all here for, right? But there are other innovations, I think, that spring from this moment and have arguably been waiting in the wings a bit too. Digital innovation is really important. It's a remote world for better or worse. And I think we're obviously a lot of us living through that now, the reality of that or the need to advance some of those digital health systems so that the work can still happen remotely. And that is a huge opportunity for the same level of partnership, right? And cooperation, not just involving industry or the private sector, and frankly, not just involving the healthcare sector, but also pulling in actors from Silicon Valley here in the US or others in the tech sector, let alone, again, people grounded in communities and on the front lines who really understand what's needed there to deliver the highest quality care to the most people.
So the events of this last year have ensured that we as a collective society can no longer ignore the pervasive injustice faced by people of color in the United States, here in the United Kingdom, and indeed across the world. And the Global Health Council recently released a statement titled, "Racism is a Global Health Issue." That must intuitively be right, but can you explain what is meant by that phrase?
I think over the years, and even this year somewhat, I think there were organizations in the US who knew finally that racism was a problem here still, and that it was heartbreaking and egregious to witness and endure the violence, especially against Black lives in our country, but then to understand that was a trend across the Black diaspora, frankly, right? And yet, I think there was a bit of a struggle on the part of some people to reconcile that reality or understanding with their, what they would see as their day-to-day work or mission, particularly in global health and international development. I think for some people, they said, well, sure, we work on global health, but this is a separate social or even political issue for us, this movement for Black lives. And what I was trying to pull out, which is something that's, I think, clearer when we think about U.S. domestic public health, is that there's really no separating the two, right? I mean, if Black and brown people around the world are mistreated or otherwise marginalized, that leads to or otherwise fuels their lack of access to preventive or healthcare services and puts them at the back of the line when it comes to the chance or opportunity they have to live healthy, productive lives. And again, like you said, we know this intuitively, but it's not always something that is accepted or embedded at an institutional level, right? I think it's hard for individuals to get behind, beyond, excuse me, the personal to the professional. And so when we talk about racism as a global health issue, it's really an effort to have people sit with that and recognize that anything that will put those Black, brown, indigenous, or other people of color at the back of the line is ultimately going to have a negative effect on any ways that we as global or international do-gooders are trying to to save lives. You know, you just can't separate the two. And even further, I'll add that obviously this is not just a US or UK issue, right? When I at least talk to some of our partners on the continent and elsewhere, you know, they talk about how they have experienced this for themselves and how this sort of discrimination or racism manifests in their own context. And so something else that I've been trying to do and we've been trying to do at Global Health Council is help leaders of organizations, again, try not to separate the two. One is a US issue and then the other sort of this global or international context, but really see how, again, one bleeds into the other. And yes, it complicates things, one might say, but that's, again, who we are. The world is complicated. And so we have to address that head on with solutions that are just as layered.
So you recently launched a digital mini series entitled, I believe, Black Voices in Global Health. I'd love to know what you've learned from those conversations.
Well, thanks for asking about that, Paul. Yeah, I did do that, did a little mini series over the summer with all the free time I have, clearly. And I was really grateful to people who were able and willing to talk to me. And I have to say, my goal with that was rather personal. Being a Black woman, I think, was finding my own way to process the events of the year and even before this year, frankly. And I also wanted to create space for others like me to process. And so it almost, while they were recorded and made public, they were conversations that we were just having on our own, kind of around the virtual kitchen table. And so some of the things we talked about included leadership in global health organizations and the lack of diversity at leadership levels. And so talking to a group of other Black women who are in not executive, but at least leadership positions, we were able to trade stories around our career path, right? And ways that we feel we might have been kind of given a leg up or perhaps pushed down in our efforts to just continue to move up the levels of the career ladder, if you will. And I think I learned that that experience is common across people like me, but also that some of those organizations kind of closing those doors might not even realize how they're doing that. And so I'm hopeful that by having this conversation and opening it up to others, that's something that can be understood by people in positions of power to really catch themselves and those biases that come into play. I also had some powerful conversations with some women who have lived and or worked on the African continent, just for their take on how particularly donor countries like the US, UK, and beyond have worked in those settings and what's most valuable to those communities and countries. And we had a number of themes come up in addition to humility and solidarity, also this very important theme of shifting the power, right? From these countries or governments that historically hold the purse strings and thus plan the goals and the players, to really transitioning that, relinquishing that, so that the people who are really living and breathing the work most readily have more of a say. And we talk about that again, we've talked about it for a while, but I think there's a learning curve and a doing curve with this. And I'm hoping again that through these few Black Voices conversations, some light bulbs went off for policymakers, for philanthropists, and others who might not recognize the effect of that more patriarchal or top-down approach to what we do. But yeah, it was really rewarding. I think the response to that was somewhat surprising, but enlightening. And I'm hoping that other people will now, you know, start to have those conversations on their own too.
I'm so struck by listening to you, because one of the things which has just been undeniable as a result of this pandemic is that it has affected poor people disproportionately. It's affected Black and brown people disproportionately. It's affected Black and brown healthcare workers disproportionately. And so if you have the leadership of healthcare organizations and organizations working in public health not reflect the people who have disproportionately suffered, then you risk perpetuating that injustice, missing the causal nature of that injustice. And that seems just to compound an injustice. So I guess I'd like to ask you, is there a comprehensive reckoning underway and a comprehensive effort to ensure that there are more diverse voices in leadership positions in the public health sector itself?
Yeah, you're absolutely right about compounding the issue, right? In this sort of never-ending cycle of people being farther and farther down that ladder. I don't know about a widespread effort. I can tell you what I'm trying to do. And I've been trying to do it since 2016 when I showed up. So I think if nothing else, those of us with the platform, and it took me a while to even recognize that I had a platform, right? but those of us with a platform with any semblance of power or privilege need to get out of the way, or at least have someone join us on those stages, right? And so one thing I try to do, and there's a lot more that I'm sure I could do, is put people up on stage and speaking roles, you know, point to the work that they do. We have an annual event, for example, one of which is coming up in another month or so, where we look at global health advocacy and kind of a year in the life of our respective campaigns and do sort of a postmortem or lessons learned of the year, but also take stock of how we move forward. And that's important because, first of all, that's just important work to do. But also, I just want to be clear that I'm not just bringing in Black and brown people to talk about Black and brown things, right? Like for a diversity conversation or conference. But when it comes to global health, when it comes to global health advocacy or programs, that should just be a more diverse dialogue. And what I think many of us have seen happen is often, frankly, there are a lot of white faces, there are a lot of white men that are leading the work and then talking about the work. And maybe if we want to have a representative from XYZ country or community, then we'll have some level of diversity. But often when it comes to quote unquote expert dialogues and discussions, I think that diversity has been lacking. And so it's been my mission, and now it's more outward, but frankly, it's always been my mission behind the scenes to ensure that it's majority people of color on that stage who are talking to us about what they think should happen and what we should all be doing. Why can't people of color be seen as experts? Why can't people from countries or communities be seen as experts? And I know that Global Health Council has been limited really in our size and level of resources in terms of how many people we've been able to bring in, especially if it's an in-person event. And I'm incredibly grateful that in this virtual environment, that's not a limitation in the way that it has been in previous years. And so you'll look at the mosaic for our event this year and you'll see what I'm talking about.
So I'd like to ask you a question. If you had magical powers and could make a change or affect a difference in the world of healthcare, what would you focus on? There's so many things that seem ripe for remedy, but what would you focus on?
Wow. If I had a wand, I think I would actually try and find some way for those of us who work in health to recognize and even reach out to those in other areas, like think about economic development, think about the climate, think about the overlapping nature of all of our issues. I love health, and I believe firmly that health is wealth. I also know that health is critically dependent or reliant on a number of other factors. And I don't know if we work hard enough in our community to look up from what it is we're doing and reach beyond ourselves and our world to understand the linkages between health and other issues that affect people. Just take COVID, for example, or other outbreaks that WHO and other agencies have fought back in recent years. Arguably, some of those, if not all of them, have been spurred or exacerbated by climate change, right? As an example, whether you think about the emergence of diseases themselves, like a Zika, or if you just think about migration patterns, right? And thus the movement of people putting those same people at risk or at a different level of risk than they had been. And yet there is not a, I think, strong relationship across the goals and activities of, say, the health and climate community. And I think we can take that to something like economic development as well, right? We look at the youth bulge on the continent of Africa that people are anticipating will have great effects on that region over time. What are we doing as a health community to really understand and support what economic development looks like in the region? Because if people are poor, as we know, right, they're not necessarily going to be healthy. So we have to make it our business to understand their risk for impoverishment. And so I think that's my wand, right? That's my magic trick is helping people understand that it's not an either or proposition. It doesn't mean that you're walking away from your core mission to care about the world in a more systemic, holistic way. After all, people are people. And we have to meet them where they are.
So I should imagine, as a person who spent my entire career trying to look at the world from the perspective of the most vulnerable, I should imagine this must be a very hard and bleak moment. If you're thinking about the impact on poverty, on racism, on life opportunities, indeed on the future that this pandemic has kind of wrought upon us. And nevertheless, despite that, what is it that gets you up in the morning? What is it that gives you hope in these extraordinarily challenging times?
I think what gets me up is knowing, I think more than anything, people want to see and do good in the world. I truly believe that. And I know it sounds Pollyannish and idealistic, and that's fine. If I need to be known as an idealist, I'll take it. But it's because I've seen it, right? Even the people who are frustrated, even the people who might seem to be working against some of what we're saying and doing. I think ultimately the majority of people around the world really want to see change in a positive direction. And so I'm ready to get up every day and do that. And I think more than wanting to see change, I think there are a number of people who are willing to work together to realize that change, right? So not everyone needs to, nor can they go it alone. I think they believe strongly in community and the power thereof. And I am heartened every day, every hour, frankly, with the reminder that there is more to this than me. And there's more to this than now. There's tomorrow, and there's the promise of people coming together to make that a better place.
So somebody who's listening to this who would find it hard, I would suggest, not to be inspired and says, I want to do that. And I want to build a career in healthcare and in public health, and I want to make a positive impact. What's your advice to them as to how they go about doing that?
I think that there are going to be more entry points to this than fewer in the coming months and years. But I think you can even start small, right? If you can't or don't want to change careers, there's little ways you can participate in the beautiful world of global health and global health advocacy in particular. You can sign up for updates from an organization like ours or others who are trying to push for this type of change, you know, writing to world leaders about what's important to you, signing onto those letters, like those little acts really matter, right? There were over a thousand people who signed onto a letter to protect WHO in a matter of days. And that was a global effort. And that was really, it was really great to see, right? There are things that also people can do in their communities to support healthcare workers or otherwise people at risk for poor health outcomes. Again, there's advocacy campaigns that are always underway around those issues. But even sort of real time, you know, showing up to be helpful at clinics and hospitals and the like, I think that there are often opportunities, and again, probably even more so in the coming months and years to show up. There are a number of things that people on the front lines face, but fatigue is very much one of them. And so I think the times I've seen people support frontline workers with food or funds or something else, that's buoyed them, because it's been a really hard time for everyone around the world dealing with this, especially people who have to face it every day. So those small acts of kindness and engagement can really go a long way. And beyond that, goodness. I mean, if we get more epidemiologists out of this, if we get more researchers and innovators out of this, you know, it's a good thing, right? I think we will likely continue to face these types of things, hopefully not to this magnitude in the coming years, but certainly we'll be at risk for another COVID. And I think if there are more people who want to suit up and boot up and help us beat back the next version, we welcome that too. it takes getting educated, you know, it doesn't happen over Twitter. but yeah, I think I welcome a new generation of actors, donors, mobilizers who want to get behind this, particularly a diverse set of those actors, right? People from all around the world, from all levels of society who want to join the ranks of others who are doing this work. We need you, for sure.
Lois Pace, your optimism and your hopefulness is, dare I say it, infectious. And I'm very grateful for all of your words. And I think everybody who works in public health and trying to deliver a more equitable set of outcomes should be equally grateful too. So thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you, Paul. I've had fun.
Thank you for listening to Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. To learn more about the Johnson & Johnson Center for Health Worker Innovation, please visit chwy.jnj.com. Once more, chwy.jnj.com. And for more information on The Conduit and our community of change makers, please visit theconduit.com.